Great. Thank you so much, Patrick, Peter, and Dina. It was really great to see your presentations. And for those of you who have joined, if you'd like to review any portion of the presentation, you can see that it is available for download at the bottom left of your screen. All right, we've had some great engagement in the chat box. Thank you so much to everyone who posted a question or a comment or shared a story from your work. We really appreciate seeing the quickly moving text there in the chat box. So we've had a lot of questions come through. We've been collecting them along the way, and we have about 25 minutes or so to get through as many of them as we can now. So I'm going to run through a few questions. I'll generally direct them towards the person for whom that question came during your presentation, but of course all three presenters are welcome to chime in on any question. Feel free to just to break in and you know, start speaking if you are interested in adding something to that question. This can be a little bit of an informal back and forth. And let's see. Going through the questions that came in, one interesting one came in during Peter's presentation. So Peter, perhaps you can start with this question. One sec, I'm just pulling it up. But actually, it was echoed again towards the end of the three presentations. So Matthew Krauss said, to drive scale and thus impact, it seems to me that we should be talking more about connecting all of these innovations in question to the private sector that can commercialize. And then Virginia Sopila said to Dina, can you speak more specifically as to how the private sector is engaged in this research, particularly as it pertains to work with commercial potential such as storage solutions? So I was hoping that all three labs could touch a bit on your engagement with the private sector, what that has looked like in the past, what it might look like going forward. And Peter, do you want to kick that off?
Sure, sure. Really, really good question. And I think, you know, not in my top 10 there is kind of a theme that says that really our work is a bridge to the private sector really taking off and taking over from the development efforts. So helping that and supporting the private sector is central to what the Soybean Innovation Lab tries to do. I'll give you a couple of examples. One, we're currently engaged in northern Ghana and in Ethiopia is a question about soil pH. Soybean is very sensitive to low pH, and little work has been done among the development community in terms of first soil testing, which is so critical for tropical soybean, and then soil correction. And the challenge is correcting these soils using lime. Lime is very bulky, not very expensive, but very bulky, and a logistical challenge for smallholders. So we're partners. There's a company, a Swiss company called Omia, that has developed a prill, a very small micro-grained form of lime called calciprill. And they really they have not applied it or tested it in a developing country setting. We've brought that product in, working with the private sector. But you don't just want to go immediately to farmer trials or demo plots, right? You want to have good evidence. This is what Feed the Future and Global Food Strategy, based on evidence, is asking us to do. Provide some formal evidence to guide companies like Omia. So we partner with them on our smart farms in Ghana and Ethiopia. We are now trialing this calciprill product as a solution for smallholders. So it's very much working in partnership, listening to what the needs of the private sector are, and then bringing them into your, you know, I don't want to call it research. It is research, but it's very applied and really oriented to the needs of the practitioner, in this case, the private sector. So that's one example that I'd use.
And Dina or Patrick, would you like to follow up? Dina, perhaps, second?
Sure. Yeah, I can jump in. And so our private sector partners, they're diverse, and it does vary a bit in the country in which we work and what makes sense in the context in which we're working. I think one particularly good example where we have engaged actually the in-country private sector is our work in Bangladesh. Our team at Bangladesh Agricultural University, a big part of their work that they're doing is on hermetic storage. However, their work includes GrainPro and Pix bags, but neither of those are available in country, and so they are currently at a price point that is above what the average farmer can afford, especially to have multiple one of these bags on their farm. Excuse me. And so what we've been actively doing is engaging with ACI, which is the largest manufacturer in Bangladesh, and partnering with them to actually produce the hermetic bags locally. And so that's something that we're working toward currently, but with the goal that and they have agreed to produce these bags, and they've agreed to do the first run for free with an agreement from Bangladesh Agricultural University that they provide the technical expertise that goes with distributing these bags. And so they'll basically be selling them at cost to farmers once that production happens. And so that the goal of that to provide an opportunity for these farmers to actually so the demand exists, and so if we can reach that price point, we have the potential to have a real impact on these storage management practices. And then in addition, we're advancing kind of local industry instead of just focusing on only like U.S.-based private partners. So that's one example that I think is a good one for what we're trying to do in the countries that we're working in.
Thank you, Dina. And Patrick, do you have any comments on private sector engagement as well?
I agree with both speakers that private sector matters for so much of value chain work and agriculture in general. I think recognition that private sector has an important role in protecting diets, essentially, is a more recent realization. And there are a number of universities that are working with the labs or independently looking at hermetically sealed bags. There are commercial companies in the U.S. And others now appearing in Africa and Asia where they're looking at storage technologies. Right now, they are often a little expensive. So, and some of the evidence of effectiveness still needs scrutiny. But there's no question that private sector has a role to play in developing technologies, appropriate and affordable technologies, for post-harvest storage, but also for getting higher quality seeds to the field that can prevent pest and insect damage, that allows molds, for example, mycotoxins to attack those plants, the appropriate kinds of fertilizers. All of those are private sector domains that need to be expanded with a view to better understanding of why it matters in relation to toxin contamination of the food supply. And I would just, in beyond private sector, I think there's a growing demand in the public sector, in the extension domain, in terms of ag extension, but also health service, primary health care service. There's demand in many countries for what should ag extension agents and primary health care givers, what should they be aware of, what messages should they be imparting to members of households, to enable them to be more aware and of the threats and the potential solutions so that they can generate more demand that can be met by the private sector for the appropriate technologies. So I think it's not just private or public. It's the interaction of the two that will work at scale.
Thank you, Patrick. And I'd like to follow up with a question that came in during your presentation, Patrick, that you answered a little bit in the chat box, but I think could stand to be answered verbally as well. Anna Twomlow, recognizing that the Nutrition Innovation Lab has an incredible wealth of research findings that are being produced, asked about how your findings can be scaled up to make an impact at the country level to stop stunting. And a little bit further, if you wouldn't mind digging in a bit more into how the Nutrition Innovation Lab's findings can be used in a practical sense for nutrition programming, especially by people who may not be connected with or aware of what your lab is doing.
That's a pretty broad question, Julie. It's really important that, you know, what we are also, like other labs, working on technologies. For example, in Bangladesh, very closely at certain drying and storage technologies that can help extend life span, let's say, of perishable nutrient-rich foods, whether they're horticulture, vegetable, or potentially even fish aquaculture foods. So some of the technologies that we're exploring are looking at how do you enhance the availability and accessibility, not just to the producer, but to consumers that are market-based, of foods with key nutrients that are essentially in nutrient-rich, therefore perishable foods. So that's slightly different from storing grains or storing bulk commodities post-harvest. It's enhancing the nutrition of the diet of producer and non-producer in low-income settings. The kind of work the Innovation Lab is doing at that kind of scale includes pretty important assessment of market access. To what extent being close or distant from markets is a major driver of agricultural decisions and decisions to buy or sell different kinds of commodities. You know, one might believe that that's stuff has been known for a very long time through the ag econ communities, and it has. But our panel research, for example, in Nepal that I mentioned, is showing just how important it is to understand that when one promotes, for example, production diversification, assuming that that will lead to diet diversification, one of the key outcomes of concern for the food security strategy, well, promoting diversification seems to work when households are distant from functioning markets and not accessible with good roads, because they are relying relatively more on own production, not entirely, but relatively more. The closer you get to markets where there is high demand for commodities you can sell at a reasonable price, then actually specialization kicks in. And you get less production diversity, but more diet diversity that is coming off the market. So the kinds of, we're looking not just at technologies, but at the right investments. You know, roads and bridges may well be in really important nutrition-sensitive investments to enhance diets. And we're also then looking at policies and strategies so that we can tailor the messages to appropriately. So it's not just everyone should diversify their production base. That is important in some areas, but not others.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'll skip down to a question that came in during Dina's presentation for the Post-Harvest Loss Lab. Joan Jennings asked, or stated, that we have found some projects to use low-tech techniques recommended by national ministries of agriculture to measure moisture, such as using salt or sugar in a storage receptacle. Does the Post-Harvest Lab have any experience information on results with these? And Dick Tinsley chimed in to ask, can't an experienced person tell moisture mostly by feel? Not perfect, but accurate enough. Would you mind chiming in on those questions?
Sure, or at least I will do my best. Thanks, John, for that question. It's actually an interesting one, and it was one that actually was a topic of debate at our annual meeting this year. I think one of the challenges that we find as these innovation labs that are university-based organizations is that we have researchers doing the work who are very much researchers, and so we've actually had some of our researchers that don't think that the SALT method, for example, is a good method, and they want something that is more specific. However, others that have more of a practitioner base, swear by that SALT method. And so we don't have any exact research on the SALT method in the work that we have done, but we know that some of that work is out there, and I think that's that constant
person
pull between what, the perfect getting in the way of the good, and how do we have really good research but have it be accessible. And so, I think there's some push and pull there. To the question about testing by feel, one of the main problems with just doing it by feel, and certainly we see a lot of farmers that do it by feel or do it by a bite test where they'll bite into the grain and see how dry it is. The problem is that to create an environment in which something like aflatoxin can thrive, that difference in moisture doesn't have to be that much. So, for example, for maize, it's recommended to dry down to around 12%, but often that grain gets stored at 14% or above. And a 14% stored grain can create those conditions for those fungal toxins to thrive. And so while it might seem like those are really close together, the implications of even that small difference in percentage can be very great. And so having more accurate moisture measurement other than just feel can really ultimately have an impact on people's health and livelihoods.
Thank you so much, Dina. All right, another question came in from Archie Jarman that I think is of relevance to all of the innovation labs, but it came in during Peter's presentation, so perhaps, Peter, you can kick off the answers. He said, I am curious if you as the innovation lab use the web, such as the AgriLinks website, to share all of this great knowledge that you are producing and or are developing a knowledge bank to fill in the gap when you cannot be on the ground. And I think we can expand that question a little bit for each lab to tell us about how you are cataloging and storing the knowledge that you're generating, and also how you are sharing it both with other innovation labs and with other USAID implementers on the ground.
Yep. Let's see. I clicked. Yeah, there we go. Thanks. Great question. And probably shouldn't have gotten me started on this topic, because this is a very, very important topic that I think is under-studied or under-kind of approached. The short answer is SIL is a highly engaged in web-based tech transfer and webinars. All our meetings we use a GoToMeeting platform, whether it's GoToMeeting or GoToWebinar. We're just constantly using it. It's essential. It's absolutely essential. And the question is bang on. We're very sensitive to moving people around, especially moving people back here, but moving people around is, we feel, is not a good use of USAID dollars and development dollars. But that opens up a much bigger question about the connectivity of our partners, and that's where we're spending a lot of time now. And I think that a lot of development value could be released if investment were placed on improving the connectivity of our partner institutions and organizations where we're supporting, whether it be the private sector or whomever. There's a lot of capacity on the continent in terms of connectivity, and we found that last mile connectivity is what falters. I think we would be able to use development dollars much more wisely to have much greater impact if we really focused on this one infrastructure investment connectivity for our partners. But there's a lot more on that subject, but I'll leave it there. And I really thank the questioner for asking it, because it really is very, very important for effective development and stewarding scarce resources.
It was mostly a question about knowledge sharing, how each of the labs is cataloging its knowledge, whether that be through the web or through another means, and how you are kind of actively engaging with other partners to share all of this, all of these great research results.
And obviously, I agree with Peter, hugely important. Several ways, the Nutrition Innovation Lab.org website, all publications are there, presentations are there, every event. So that's open for everyone. And of course, all the data collected will be open access. So these large surveys that I'm talking about offer a wealth of household level and farm level information that we're actively promoting, particularly developing country partners, to access and use for their own purposes, and we'll certainly engage with them in that. I literally just came back last night from Nepal, where we have an annual, this was the fifth annual scientific symposium we've organized, I have to say, funded by the USAID mission, which sees the importance of building capacity and sharing information. We had over 400 registrants for this five-day symposium this year, and we use that as a kind of real-time outreach to all our collaborators, scientific and research and programming, but especially in Nepal, but especially policymakers. So we actively bring in civil servants and policymakers from all sectors, agriculture, health, livestock, WASH, so that there's an actual dialogue around implications of research as it is coming out, right? A real-time engagement. This year, we opened it up so it was global. There were many participants from Africa and as well as South Asia. So yes, web-based and engagement is really important, but so are those kind of fora where you bring researchers to engage and interact directly with policymakers, and you can have vastly more impact through that kind of engagement than simply publishing papers. So it's really important to find the appropriate ways. The other, finally, is that the Nutrition Lab has been very active in developing curricula with universities in the countries in which we work, as well as programs of both education and research. So we've set up a master's in nutrition and public health in Nepal. We've set up the country's first dietetics program in Malawi, for example, just two examples. And this is another way of building in new data, new findings relevant to those countries into training programs within tertiary institutions in those countries. But especially building in the skill sets, you know, not just research findings, but what it took to do this research, and working with local faculty to build up capacity, essentially a training of trainers, but an academic and scientific training of trainers, so that we're leaving behind capacity in countries to undertake and understand this kind of work, not just share findings.
Thank you, Patrick. And Dina, would you like to discuss this a bit as well?
Sure. Or I'll just say, in the interest of time, I think I'll just say that I very much agree with the points and the priorities that both Peter and Patrick have laid out, and really just say that it's an area we're continuing to work toward as a program. I think that we've got a lot of room for growth, but certainly I think that all of those avenues to disseminate information are important, and we're continuing to try to get our findings out more across all those platforms. So it was a well-placed question, and thank you for it.
Great. Thank you, Dina, and I agree. All right, we're all just about at time, but I wanted to squeeze in one final question for Patrick that came in almost right at the beginning of the presentation from Gary Alex, who stated that the finding that sheep and goats in the house is related to environmental enteropathy is very interesting. Have there been any analyses of the social factors that might affect this, such as caste or the number of small ruminants owned? And as a side question, just how do we take into account such unintended consequences from the promotion of nutritious foods? Can you give a brief answer or address that one?
Briefly, the intended consequences, that is something we all need to bear in mind much more. We need to promote the production and management of foods, and including animal source foods, that are crucial to improved diets and nutrition, but we do have to pay special attention to unintended consequences, which is all about appropriate management, quality of seeds or animals, effective health care of crops or animals, and so on. Yes, we are going to be digging deeper into the characteristics of households that allow ruminants to wander in and out. Obviously, chickens are another dimension of that, but that's pretty much universal, versus those that don't. This is, of course, critical for both WASH and the whole area of gut microbiome, shared pathogens between livestock and humans. This is a cutting-edge area that needs much more research. It's not easy because you have to do careful analysis, which means collection of either human and animal feces or urine, and potential, therefore lab analyses and DNA analysis. So this is an area that, for the future, where we need to understand more about not what goes into the mouth, but what comes out, what is digested or not, and to what extent the environment in which children grow up influences that. This is really important and something for the future.
Thank you, Patrick. Well, there certainly is a lot of research ahead to be done, and I know that the Innovation Labs, both the three that were showcased today and all of the Feed the Future Innovation Labs, will be delving into lots of this interesting research going forward. So I would like to extend a sincere thank you to our presenters. We really appreciate you taking the time and attempt today on an AgriLinks webinar, and we're very grateful for the information that you shared. I'd also like to thank the Feed the Future KDAD project for producing this webinar, and most importantly, I would like to thank all of you, our attendees, for making these webinars possible through signing on, through asking your questions, and for continuing to return to AgriLinks. So we'll go ahead and wrap up the webinar today. We will be taking a break in August, so no AgriLinks webinar in August, but we'll be back in September. But there will be some exciting changes on the AgriLinks.org website coming soon, so please do continue to keep an eye open for our newsletters in your inbox and signing onto the website to engage. Thank you very much, and we will see you soon.